Welcome to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back here with another segment. We're actually back with part two of the segment we started last week on hemorrhage control with our special guest, Dennis Phillips. Dr. Phillips is a trauma surgeon and brings extensive knowledge from treating battlefield injuries in Afghanistan and other locations. We also, of course, have Joe Holly with us, Dr. Joe Holly, our ER physician, and also one of the folks from Paragon Medical Education Group joining us, and of course, our co-host, Sam Bradley. So let's pick up with part two of that segment we started here at the Disaster Podcast last week on the show. What about the application of a standard tourniquet, or one of the traditional tourniquets that are available for purchase out there, or whatever one you might use? Can you give us some idea of their effectiveness level? We've heard so much about tourniquet use coming out of military studies over the last several years, that as an alternative device, if you don't have something like the IT clamp in your system yet, but you do have tourniquets, how effective are they compared to something like this?
Dennis, go ahead and take that one.
Yeah, so the standard tourniquet that's being used in both the military world and civilian world is a strap-type tourniquet. Often it's called the CAT tourniquet, combat application tourniquet, but there's some others like the soft T that are quite similar. And they're really a long strap that you feed through. You need to tighten it down. It goes through a series of loops. And then there's a windlass mechanism that you need to tighten down. And you keep tightening until bleeding stops until you can actually cut off blood flow. Now, it sounds pretty easy, but having taught people to use it, there's lots of common mistakes that are made in terms of applying it. And a lot of people will not apply it properly or tight enough, because when you need to tighten it through a big muscle like your thigh, you have to tighten it up to a point that it's causing a lot of pain, and most people don't realize how tight it needs to go. And when the military did studies in terms of how tight their tourniquets were being applied in the field, they looked at all of the tourniquets that were coming into a forward surgical hospital, and 83% of them were not tightened enough to cut off blood flow to the extremities. And part of that was that the medics that were placing these weren't realizing how tight they need to go. So, yes, they will work for the distal two-thirds of your arms and legs for bleeding wounds, but they need to be applied properly, and you need to be trained properly to apply them. And Joe, maybe you want to add to that as well.
Yeah, I think you touched on the points particularly. I've certainly noticed the same thing, and I think the biggest sort of myth I see is people think that they put the strap around the extremity, they snug it up, and then they will finish tightening this thing up with the windlass that's part of the tourniquet. And while that is completely correct, they don't appreciate, first of all, how little distance that windlass will continue to tighten that tourniquet. And so I think one of the important pieces of that is a realization that initial strap application from that tourniquet must be very tight, and that the windlass functions to snug it a little bit more, but you really need most of your tightness out of the application of the strap itself.
Sam, you had a question, I think. Why don't you jump in?
On tourniquets, and you know, interestingly, they were out of favor in the pre-hospital care environment for quite some time. I mean, completely. And then, because of all the research that was done overseas, which Dennis, you were certainly a part of, they came back in with the new tools and the new thinking, which you guys are even carrying to the next level with your myth busting here. I'm certainly learning some things. But one of the things that they told us, where we originally were taught, when you put on a tourniquet, you have to turn that faucet completely off. And when you're doing that, say on an extremity, you're sacrificing the limb for the life. And one of the things that seemed to have changed with the new training is you don't necessarily have to turn it all the way off, just enough to stop the bleeding. Dennis, is that true?
There's a certain amount of logic to that, and I would say by and large it's true, but what most people don't realize is that you need to constantly monitor that wound. So if you've got somebody who's been bleeding out, their blood pressure has dropped to 80 systolic or 90 systolic, and you've just tightened it up enough to cut off that blood flow to 80 or 90 systolic, you'll have temporarily stopped that bleeding. But what happens is that in stopping the bleeding, your body starts to bring some more fluid into the circulation, the blood pressure starts to go up, and you've only tightened it to that 80 or 90, and it's going to start to re-bleed.
Wow.
So re-bleeding from tourniquets is a well-described phenomenon. And yes, you can deal with it. You just need to crank it up tighter. But a lot of the myths about it is that you put it on and kind of forget about it. But yes, you need to constantly monitor that wound after you've put it on.
So let my little paramedic brain try to comprehend this. So you're saying when the pressure starts to build up, it can interfere with the clotting that's already begun?
Not that it's going to interfere. So the way the tourniquet works is it's cut off the flow to that vessel. And if you haven't completely shut down that artery, if you've just tightened it up enough to stop the bleeding, and if the pressure in that vessel is low because you're already in shock, as the pressure builds up, then you've overcome the pressure that you've tightened into the tourniquet, because you've just tightened it up enough to stop the bleeding at that low pressure level. Now you've got high pressure, and it starts to re-bleed. So it's all about the pressure and the tightness of the tourniquet.
Wow. Wow, that's something I learned. Jamie, what do you think? Is that something you knew?
Well, you know, I think I knew it to the extent that any intervention that we apply to a patient needs to be constantly monitored and reassessed, and we should be reassessing severe patients that are in severely critical condition more frequently than we would, say, our priority three, or our so-called green patients. So obviously, I think I knew it to a certain level, but not to the point that thinking it through that, yes, as the patient's own resources come to bear on managing their shock situation, they're going to actually overpressurize the point to which the tourniquet's been applied. This is why we have this podcast. This is why we do these things, is to really address these challenges.
Sure. And the other challenge with tourniquets is the amount of pressure required to go through a thigh. And often a single tourniquet is not enough to get enough pressure. So people need to be aware that sometimes you need to add a second one onto the thigh to generate enough pressure.
Wow. We've never been taught that. Well, do you teach that, Joe?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think the key there is a recognition that the arm and the leg are very different. The amount of muscle mass in a thigh, especially, you know, a young adult male, for example, that's a tremendous amount of muscle mass there compared to trying to get a tourniquet onto an upper extremity someplace. So a recognition for how much compression you must have to address the issues that Dennis was just talking about, I think is vitally important. You know, I think that leads to another sort of common concern about putting tourniquets down low on extremities. And by that, I primarily mean the shin and the forearm, where you've got the artery tends to run between the two bones that are in that part of the extremity. And it's almost impossible to get enough pressure to result in compression of that artery because it's so well protected between those two bones. You literally have to crush those two bones to get those things down.
So how do you manage that, Joe?
Well, I think part of the answer is, you know, clearly the tourniquet probably does better above the joint there. And a recognition that other forms of hemorrhage control may make more sense there. Certainly if you've got, that may be a place where direct pressure and packing make more sense than a tourniquet.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I remember being taught early on that, well, you always want to put a tourniquet as low as you can, especially where a joint's involved, because since we're saving the life and sacrificing the limb, we don't want to lose a joint if that's the case, if we can put the tourniquet lower. So what you're saying is quite the opposite of that.
Well, I think that concept is legitimate, but I think it was also based on some information that has not really borne out to be true, and that is that we are, in essence, sacrificing an extremity for a life. And I think, Dennis can speak to this through many years of experience, that the vast majority of injuries that have had tourniquets applied to them do not result in a loss of the extremity or necessarily even a dysfunction of that extremity, that the recovery rate is actually quite good if the bleeding can be gotten under control in a timely fashion and the patient taken care of. Would you agree with that, Dennis?
Absolutely. I personally haven't seen any long-term effects of tourniquet placement, even if it's been in place for a number of hours. We know that there comes a point, you know, probably at about the six-hour mark, where you stand a real risk of losing the limb, and we know that less than 2 hours is quite safe for their use. And then there's a gray zone in between, but you know, stopping the bleeding is the life-saving part of it. And by and large, the injury that, or the long-term disability comes from the injury and not the tourniquet.
That's really interesting, because on the very basic level we were taught that certainly wasn't the case. So you're saying that you have never seen, I mean, as far, putting the injury aside, of course, but as far as just slowing down or cutting off that circulation, you've never seen an extremity have to be amputated because of the tourniquet, Dennis?
That's correct, at least from military experience, from all of the CAT tourniquets that have come in place. Now, I will make, or I will bring up a couple of exceptions, and that's in places that I've worked in where they haven't used proper tourniquets, where they've, you know, tightened shoelaces and wires and things like that super tight around a limb. I've seen some bad consequences of that, but for the commercially applied tourniquets that have been applied in the field in the military situation, I have not seen a loss of limb from just the use of that.
Wow, that's good to know. Let me throw out another one for you. I'm thinking of all the myths I know, and they probably come from certainly lower levels of training than you guys have certainly have as doctors and trauma surgeons and even nurses. But one of the early myths was if that completely cuts off circulation and you were to loosen it at all, then these clots that were forming in the circulation would run rampant through the body and cause all kinds of chaos. Is there any truth to that, Joe?
Well, I think I'll let Dennis answer that one. Again, lots more experience with those things directly than I have even.
Yeah, I've never seen that happen in terms of clots running rampant through the circulation. What winds up happening, especially in a lower limb where you have bigger muscle mass, you've cut off the blood flow to a significant area of muscle mass, and it does become ischemic. You get acid buildup, and so you may get some sequelae from when you release it, that you now have a burden of acid and other things that have built up because you haven't had blood flow through there.
So it's sort of like we did a whole segment on crush injury, and Joe is quite the expert at that. So it's that reperfusion injury. But would this be obviously to a much lesser degree, if it was an isolated extremity, than certainly the chest or the abdomen? So how critical would that be for a patient, if, you know, barring all the other injuries and so forth? How big of a problem would that be, Dennis?
So if you're an otherwise healthy person and that's your only injury and your coagulation system is intact, it's probably quite manageable. Ideally, the tourniquet's released at a hospital and surgical conditions where you've got fairly good IV access and you can perfuse quite nicely. But generally in the field, if you've got a tourniquet on, I don't see a role for loosening it to try to reperfuse the limb. I don't think there's any benefit from that. And if you've got somebody who's on the borderline of in terms of their acid-base balance, and you've got that additional burden of acid buildup and other toxic buildup, that may be something that pushes them over the edge. And I don't think there's any added benefit to whatever slight perfusion you might get into that extremity.
Wow. Jamie, I think we should subtitle this "Everything I Should Have Learned in Paramedic School and Didn't."
Well, I think, Sam, in a lot of cases, you know, it's been two different things. One is the science here has changed pretty dramatically in the last 10 or 15 years or so. And I think also it's been a misperception that the details here aren't important. All you got to do is just, you know, tie something around that extremity and tie it off. And as Dennis just discussed, you know, things like wires and, you know, ropes, may do more harm than good. And so the devil is indeed in the details here of not only sort of wound packing and but tourniquet use, and I think even the devil is in the details in the old idiom of ABC approach to a patient who's got severe hemorrhage. I think the idea that you're going to mess around for a few minutes getting their airway taken care of when they're, you know, have blood squirting from a lacerated femoral artery is pound wise and or penny wise and pound foolish. You know, it's not that those people don't need their airway taken care of, but if you don't get their hemorrhage under control and have enough of a blood pressure to continue perfusion, then their airway is pretty irrelevant in those cases. And so I think in situations like that, the first thing you need to be doing is getting that hemorrhage under control as quickly as you can, so that you can stop the ongoing onset of shock and maybe even keep the patient functional enough that they can protect their own airway, or at least that's something could be taken care of in a few minutes.
Really good point. So clearly this is what you guys are teaching at Paragon. You're obviously very up on the latest thinking and the latest science. So it's good to know that what you're down there really is, because I've heard people come from a lot of these similar type trainings and going, wow, this medicine is really outdated, but clearly that's not the case for you guys.
Well, I think that's a lot of what we try to do, is to stay on the cutting edge, no pun intended, for tonight's episode, with what's going on, in the world, what's developing. We think a pretty innovative way of teaching people, and we like to supplement and show off very innovative products that are clearly making a difference. And part of the reason that I've gotten to know Dennis and had the pleasure of working with him is he's a very innovative thinker and has developed a marvelous product that I think can truly change the scene when it comes to managing severe hemorrhage in patients.
Well, and I appreciate the fact that this is invented by somebody that knows what they're doing, because they've been out there, they've used it, they've seen what happens when bleeding control isn't done correctly. And so this has got a lot of merit just from that alone.
And if you want to get your hands on something like this and try it out, that's one of the things that Joe and the guys at Paragon are so well known for, is you can touch and manage and handle these devices in a cadaver lab situation, even apply it to an actual wound site and see how it works with a human tissue. Dennis, it's amazing. I always liked this device just from interviewing you before about it and making you one of our product picks at a past expo in our podcast studio. But I have a lot more appreciation for it, because I always, and I didn't do it justice, because I always stacked it up in my mind next to a tourniquet as a similar device, as far as what it did. But I've got a much greater appreciation because of just the simplicity of it, of the IT clamp, and how easy it is to apply versus what you've taught me just today about how tourniquets are not trained in their proper use. They aren't often used correctly. And while they can work, why not use a device that's much simpler to apply and manage the patient with? So thank you for being an innovator.
Well, thank you.
I would second that.
So, I want folks to know where they can look at this. And this is not the IT clamp show. I want you to know that. And Dennis Dennis didn't come on to talk about that. He came on to talk about hemorrhage control, and we've done a lot of talk about hemorrhage control, but I want to give them their due. iTraumaCare.com. You can look at it. There's a video, great video segment there right on the site that you can click on and see it in action. See how it works. I urge you to take a look at it, and I'll have a link in the show notes on this episode for my video review of this product from a year or so ago at, I think, EMS World Expo. So you can actually see what my take is. Chris Montero and a few other podcasters got their hands on this device and see what we thought of it then. Although my appreciation has gone up even more just having Dennis here and comparing the discussion about two different types of hemorrhage control. And clearly the IT clamp just seems to be the best choice. We're going to have to look a lot harder why we don't have something like this in our system.
And I remember, too, interviewing some of the folks after the last cadaver lab that we had, and that was the item to be discussed. That was something that really impressed people, that had of course, I had never seen anything quite like it. So that now has surfaced in my memory as something that really did impress people, especially when they got the chance to really use it on live tissue. Well, not live tissue, but real tissue.
Well, I think you guys are right on. I mean, Dennis is being very humble, as he always is. And I think one thing that's important to point out is that the IT clamp isn't really meant to be a substitution for a tourniquet. It fits somewhere in between the direct pressure and put a tourniquet on it kind of spectrum. So there is a niche where it fits nicely. And although he hasn't said it, that there's a lot of work that's been done, and version two is on the horizon. So I'll just tease you a little bit with that, the device has already had some additional innovations to it.
Well, Dennis, thank you so much for coming on the Disaster Podcast, and I hope maybe we can get you back on here again in the future, just to pick your brain some more about how we can improve our trauma care in the field so that we can get these patients to the hospital and definitive care and a trauma surgeon to fix the problem.
And I think the key here that is to do a lot of training, that there are a variety of tools out there, but we need to learn to train with all of them properly. IT clamp included, it does require some training, and although it's much easier to use than other devices, and each of the tools works in a different way, and ultimately you're treating the wound, and you need to be able to think about the wound and what combination of tools or even a single tool is going to be best for that particular wound. And so we really need to start thinking about the wounds and the toolkit that we've got and how we can train people to best stop the bleeding.
Well, thanks again for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. Joe, where can folks find you guys at Paragon, and if they want to get their hands on some of these hot new products and see them in action?
Well, you can find Paragon on the web at www.paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook under the same name. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
Great. Well, thanks again for go ahead.
And I should also let people know that the Paragon training program is really a critical piece in terms of what they're doing, because they're enabling people to learn to use the set of tools properly in the field. And I think that's the right approach, is education and training is what's going to make a big difference. And I think Joe's made some huge strides, and we should look to what Paragon's doing as an example for EMS training nationwide.
And I agree completely, Dennis. It's one of the reasons we're so proud to have them as our supporter here of the Disaster Podcast, and helping us bring this show out every single week to cover the topics we cover and bring people like you in to help us understand and do a better job of what we do in the field. And so thank you very much. Thank Joe very much. It's just great to be able to have these resources and then make some of your knowledge available to the audience. Sam, where can we find you?
And I will second the fact, I'd love to have Dennis back and pick his brain on his expansive expertise as a trauma surgeon. You can usually find me at the usual social media places, SamBradley11 at Twitter, and I noticed I'm picking up quite a few Twitter followers. I hope it's because of this podcast. Sam Bradley on Facebook, and certainly on the DisasterPodcast.com website.
And, you know, folks, if you want to check out the show and all of our other episodes, you know, make sure you head over to disasterpodcast.com. Let us know what you want more of by leaving a comment on any of the episode articles there. Right at the bottom is a place where you can leave that comment. It actually emails us and lets us know, and we will actually respond back to you. One of us, maybe all of us, respond back to you with a comment in reply to what you have to say or ask about. So please keep in touch with us. We've been in touch with listener Tim again recently via email to check in and find out more about Wilderness EMS. And we've got other topics that are in the pipeline based upon your recommendations and questions. So keep them coming. Keep putting comments over at disasterpodcast.com. Let us know what you want more of. Do you want to have Dennis back? What topic would you like him to talk about next time when we can wrangle some free time from him? And we'd love to find out what you'd like to hear about. So check that out over at disasterpodcast.com. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Of course, you can find me under the handle Pod Medic everywhere. And that's the easiest way to catch up with me. You can also find my other programs and shows like the Disaster Podcast over at medicast.com. That's it for me, Sam. You know, this just goes to point out that everything we do in disaster medicine and preparedness training is really, you know, a lot different than what we might expect sometimes.
Wow. And tonight's discussion surely illustrated that, but disaster and in the field as well. There's a lot we have to relearn. So as we would say, and we would say it just as much as about bleeding control, is the fact that disaster medicine is not everyday medicine.